how quickly life can tumble. From candlelit dinner to this.
911.
Hi. We just got shot. My wife got shot.
The long married couple's date night in Manhattan wasn't supposed to end this way. Not on a dark road. Not with a gunman beside the window of their Mitsubishi. Not with the crack of gunfire.
I'm trying to get my wife to the hospital. I think she's living. I think she got shot.
The day had begun like so many other lazy Saturday mornings in a well-heeled New York City suburb of good homes, good schools, and solid families. Carlos Perez Olivo, 58, a well-known criminal defense attorney, was puttering around the family's two-story cobalt blue Center Hall colonial, just three doors down from their very famous neighbors Bill and Hillary Clinton in the desirable village of Chappaqua. Carlos's wife Peggy, 55, worked as a teaching assistant during the week, and as Carlos joked, reported to her second job of shopping the town's upscale boutiques on the weekends. Carlos and Peggy's two older boys were off on their own now. Carlitos, 29, had followed in his dad's footsteps and was now a lawyer. Merced, 23, was out in Colorado finishing college. Alicia, 16, a bubbly high school cheerleader, was still living at home. She was going out with friends that night. After raising three children in their almost 30 years of marriage, Carlos and Peggy were enjoying their new freedom from the unrelenting pace of full-time parenting duties.
We wanted to enjoy ourselves while we were young. I think we both were deathly afraid of getting old. And we saw too many people who became old and then couldn't really enjoy themselves. They had money, but they couldn't enjoy themselves.
So that evening, they decided to make a night on the town of it. Peggy went on the internet and bought some movie tickets. The plan, drive into New York, see the film, maybe do a little shopping, and have a nice dinner.
We were going to go in her car, but they didn't have gas, so we went in mine and had a little bit of gas.
It was November 18th, 2006, the week before Thanksgiving, and New York wasn't yet overrun with the usual madness the Christmas season would bring, the calm before the holiday storm.
And we walked around for about 20 minutes because we were quite early. She wanted to see the stores, and we walked back. We saw the movie.
Later, they went to a favorite French bistro.
We had a wonderful dinner.
A lot of cosmopolitans on the table that night?
Yes. Peggy had two or three, I don't know. I had about five or six. We enjoyed going out to dinner and we enjoyed having a drink.
But now it was time for the hour drive home north to Chappaqua. As they started to make their way out of the city, Frank Ferullo, one of Carlos's closest friends from their college days at Columbia, had played telephone tag with Peggy that evening.
I could tell that they'd been out to dinner or something because she was very happy and very bubbly, and she was actually even trying to speak with a French accent.
Carlos, as usual, did the driving.
Normally, we'd get in the car and she put on a classical rock station, and invariably she would fall asleep.
Alicia, their 16-year-old, called her mom's cell phone as they were driving home from the city, asking them to pick her up at a friend's house later that night.
She was having a really good time, and I told her I loved her, and she loved me, and my dad says he loves me too.
Carlos said Peggy soon drowsed back to sleep. Meanwhile, the fuel gauge was reading low. Carlos said he was determined to make it to his favorite gas station, the one with the rock-bottom prices, but also off the highway down a dark stretch of road. When it came to a gallon of gas, Carlos was as tight as a tick.
Whereas I might have spent whatever I wanted to spend on meals or a bottle of wine, for whatever reason, the idea of spending 15 cents more a gallon from one station to another was offensive to me.
The stretch of Route 100 he exited onto was quiet at that hour, but Carlos wasn't apprehensive. He was on familiar turf. Even though he was an attorney who defended some of the worst lowlifes New York City had to offer, once he crossed that county line, he always breathed a sigh of relief.
That's why we moved up to Westchester, because we felt up here it was safer.
But this autumn night, something was very different. In the past 3 months, Carlos had stopped practicing law. He'd been disbarred after some clients had accused him of running off with their money. And while he said he was relieved to be moving on to a new stage in his life, he'd left behind a trail of angry former clients.
There had been some threats and some problems. obviously, people that weren't happy with me.
You represented some tough customers.
Yes, I did.
Were any of them present tense in your life at that point?
I had gotten some threats a year before, 6 months before. You know, it had been communicated to U.S. attorneys and stuff like that.
Carlos made his way toward the gas station. Peggy was sound asleep in the seat beside him, the radio droning oldies. He'd look back at that moment later, thinking life had never seemed better. What a nice evening out it had been. A marriage still intact after 30 years, 3 accomplished children, and he was finally out from under the relentless pressure of practicing law.
It was like a big load had been taken off my shoulders. I was enjoying myself. I was able to be more at home than I was before.
But the concept of home, time with Peggy, was about to be changed forever. A car had loomed up out of nowhere, overtaking, now cutting him off. The car had stopped, and a ball-cap man with a gun had jumped out of the back. He could do the drive from Manhattan to his home in Westchester on autopilot. But in seconds, on this Saturday night, on a dark stretch of road, shrieking trouble had found Carlos Perez Olivo as he recounts the night.
I'm driving, and all of a sudden this car just kind of cut in front of me. My concern at the moment was not to get into an accident, for the obvious reason that I didn't want the cops coming, because I had been drinking.
Cut off and forced to the side of the road by an older model dark-colored sedan that looked to him like a Toyota.
My initial reaction was to get out of the car and yell at them.
But in an instant, a man wearing jeans and a baseball cap and who Carlos thought vaguely looked Colombian was standing by his car window, pointing a gun at him.
I froze. I should have put the car in reverse, or I should have tried to hit the car, but I didn't. And he got into the back seat. I then reacted.
Carlos started wrestling with the gunman.
I tried to grab the gun and twist it. We started struggling. He was pulling away. I was trying to pull this way, turn, twist. I was using this hand as leverage. Shots went off, and I wound up in the back seat. You know, I remember a burning, stinging sensation.
Carlos knew he had been shot. Peggy still looked asleep in the passenger seat up front. The gunman fled as Carlos got back in the driver's seat.
I turned the car on. I picked up the phone, and as I started to drive away, I called 911.
We got stopped on the side of the road. I'm going on 133. I'm trying to get to Northern Westchester.
Carlos, bleeding from his lower left side, started driving frantically to the nearest hospital about 15 minutes away.
Are you in Austin?
We just got shot.
Okay, are you in Austin? Are you an Austin?
Instead of asking me more about what I was trying to tell them about the description of the car, whatever, all they kept asking me was, where are you? Pull over, you know, wait for the ambulance.
I can't stop. I gotta get my wife to the hospital.
I kept telling them, I'm not pulling over. I'm taking my wife to the hospital. I'm not gonna pull over.
I'm trying to get my wife to the hospital.
Peggy was now slumped over in the passenger seat.
She didn't move all the way on. I drove as fast as I could. I just wanted to get somebody out and get attention to her because it was my job to take care and protect my family. And I obviously didn't do a very good job of it. So, you know, at least I could try to do is make sure that she got whatever medical attention she could as quickly as she could.
You forget about me. My wife is important. Not me.
At the hospital, Carlos lands the SUV in the guard post. The hospital security cameras catch him leaving the Mitsubishi, trying to get help for himself and his wife.
I just got out of the car as soon as I could, and I tried to get in to get medical assistance.
Carlos was rushed into the emergency room.
They took me into a room, and I remember being upset because I thought they were working on me and not doing anything with her.
The doctors gave him a sedative to calm him down. He'd been shot in the side of his stomach. Peggy had taken a bullet to the head. The couple's daughter, Alicia, waited at her friend's house for a ride home that never came.
I kept on calling my parents, and they weren't picking up. And my parents always pick up the phone, no matter what.
Alicia's brother, Merced, was away at college when he got the news to call home.
I got my brother on the phone. He said that, you know, mom, dad had been in a car accident. You know, dad was going to be okay. They weren't sure about my mom. I need to get home as soon as possible.
Alicia got the same news before dawn, her parents in a car accident. Family friends came to take her to their house to spend the rest of the night. On the way there, she convinced herself it was just scrapes and bruises.
I was like, oh, mom's fine, because my mom was always very healthy. And I was like, maybe she has like a bruised elbow or something like that.
But when she woke up the next morning, older brother Carlitos told her what had happened to their parents. She went to see her dad.
He was crying hysterically, just saying, my Peggy, just asking for my mom, my girl Peggy. He was holding onto my hand, and I've never seen my dad cry. I've never seen him just crumble and be so disheveled.
Other family members and friends started descending on the hospital as the awful news spread. Robert Buckley found his close friend Carlos in human wreckage.
In shock, in grief, drugged. He'd been shot himself. He was almost inconsolable. He wished he was dead.
Frank Farrillo also rushed to the hospital to be with Carlos.
He was broken. He was really a broken man. Everybody was distraught. Carlos was distraught, the kids were distraught, friends were distraught. How could this happen?
Exactly. How could this have happened? Peggy, 55 years old, the mother of three, was down the corridor still alive, but only barely. The 55-year-old woman being kept alive by machines in a suburban New York City hospital was an unlikely target for an unknown assailant's bullet to the head. She was wife, mother, teacher's assistant. In the 1970s, before flying became a misery, flight attendants were still known as stewardesses, and Peggy was one of them, flying for the now-defunct Eastern Airlines. It was a career that still had a slight aura of glamour to it. And it got Peggy up and away from her big family of seven sisters and one brother in their little bungalow in Lexington, Kentucky. Laura Lebowski said her older sister Peggy was determined to find adventure and escape the slow lane of their small southern city.
Peggy wanted excitement. She was the first one in the family to get out of town.
And Peggy, with her 1,000-watt smile and personality to match, would soon catch the attention of one of the frequent flyers on her trips to Puerto Rico, a charismatic, up-and-coming lawyer, Carlos Perez Olivo.
Carlos was very romantic, sensitive. He spoiled Peggy rotten, and most of us were pretty jealous that Peggy was doing exciting things, and here she had this man who gave her just everything that she could dream of.
Carlos, with his impeccable manners and big spender ease, swept the small town girl and her family right off their feet.
He was very much the ladies' man. He could charm us. Carlos loved to take everybody out for dinner and buy wine and stuff. The types of things we weren't accustomed to.
And soon the dashing lawyer and the pretty stewardess were married, and the couple's first baby arrived a year later. Peggy turned in her wings to be a stay-at-home mom, and new babies arrived like clockwork.
And every 6 years, she had a child, and I used to kid her and tell her that she would have a child because she didn't want to go back to work.
The family was finally complete with their two boys and a little girl. Alicia says she couldn't have picked a better family.
I love my family so much. My mom spoiled me to death instead of my dad, and I have very, very protective brothers, and I think I really had the perfect childhood.
Both Carlos and Peggy dove into parenting.
Our joy was our children, and I did the things that other parents, I guess, do. I became a soccer coach, not knowing anything about soccer. Basically, enjoying life with my children, with my wife. Work was something I did because I was good at it and because I had to earn a living to support my family.
Some families may run on a well-calculated master plan of upward mobility, but the Perez Olivos weren't one of them. The money came and went.
Money wasn't particularly important to Carlos, in a sense. If he had it, They spent it. When he was making a lot of money, you'd pull out your wallet to pay for something, so you don't put it away.
Looking back, even Carlos thought sometimes he was a little too free spending.
Maybe we went a little bit too overboard. My Carlitos was driving a Porsche convertible to high school.
But when the money dried up, the family simply trimmed its sails.
Our family is like a roller coaster. And it's always been that way. We'll have these wonderful highs of, you know, doing what we like, to these kind of lows, but it was never stressful in our house or a time of panic. It was just like, all right, hold off a little bit.
That's how it just went in my family. Sometimes, you know, we had a lot of money, sometimes we didn't, but I mean, eventually everything always evened out and was fine.
But in 1996, Carlos's practice hit the skids hard. So much so that Carlos decided to leave Chappaqua for Puerto Rico to jumpstart his law career. He also hoped it might pull him out of a growing depression that he believed was triggered by a bad bout of Lyme disease.
All of a sudden, I couldn't stand the cold weather. I couldn't stand the snow. I thought I was going to basically die. So I told Peggy, look, Peg, you know, let me go back to Puerto Rico. I have contacts there. I can work there.
The family tried to make the best of it, but in 1999, after three sometimes restless years in Puerto Rico, Carlos was itchy to move back to Chappaqua, the moneyed Manhattan suburb, weather be damned.
I figured I was well enough because I'd come two or three times to the United States on cases during the winter, and it didn't seem to bother me, so we moved back.
What followed was almost a vagabond experience. The family living in a hotel, then a cramped apartment over an upholstery shop. They even relied on the kindness of a family friend for a simple roof over their heads.
We lived in our friend's basement for, I think, the summer. And then we lived in a hotel room for a little bit, all of us.
Gee, that had to be tough as a family.
No, things never really got tough. Even in the worst times, we were living above an upholstery store. It never was hard. It was never stressful. I still remember really great memories and just hanging out and really loving each other.
And soon, Carlos was up and running again with new clients. And before long, they'd settled into a nice home in Chappaqua. Even after all their years together, Alicia says her parents still held hands and cuddled as though they were teens themselves.
They were always together. I don't think I could ever find them not together. They would be reading together, sitting together, watching TV. Everything was together. They got along beautifully. They were constantly holding hands, which sometimes, as a teenager especially, I was like, oh, come on, like, stop it.
With her kids all but full grown, Peggy had found work as a teacher's assistant at one of the town's grade schools, rewarding despite the paltry salary.
She was a wonderful teacher. She worked with special needs kids, and the students really loved her, and they made her like cards, and it was really good.
By 2006, 7 years after their experiment in Puerto Rico, the family seemed as good as ever. Carlos even took his girls, Peggy and Alicia, for a splurge trip to Florence in February of that year.
We got to go to all the art museums and shopping, and it was beautiful.
Everyone in the family seemed to be doing well. Carlitos, the oldest, had gotten married that August, and Carlos and Peggy had thrown him a nice party at the house and helped pay for the honeymoon. Alicia was soaring at the high school, and Merced, who transferred from West Point to a Colorado college that he felt was a better fit, was finishing up his senior year. It was a good season in the family, all in all.
I had everything I wanted, family's good, I was good, I was about to finish school, I was doing stuff I loved, I had my whole future ahead of me, and, things were going great.
But there were secrets in that nice colonial in Chappaqua. Carlos had been disbarred in August. His law career finished in disgrace after clients had accused him of spending their money that he'd held in trust. Was his own family even aware? And of course, he hadn't told Peggy about the mistress of 10 years, the one-time shop assistant from Puerto Rico. Nor had he owned up to calling escort girls for occasional sex. So that night the car with the gunman ambushed them on a dark road, there were things that Peggy would never learn about her husband, Carlos. While Carlos lay wounded in his hospital bed, the grim reality started to break through the haze of drugs the doctors had given to sedate him. Doctors had been unable to save Peggy after she suffered a catastrophic shot to the head.
My wife is dead, yes. and I'm alone, and I'm responsible for it one way or another. Because if it was random, I didn't react well, and if it wasn't random, it was because of me. And you know, she never hurt anybody. She never did anything wrong to anybody. She didn't deserve that.
What had happened that night? Was it a failed carjacking? Or perhaps a disgruntled former client out for revenge?
As a defense attorney, I mean, he dealt with some strange guys. And he'd been doing it for, what, 25, 30 years.
Carlos's friends had always worried about some of the rough characters he'd represented.
If you're a lawyer defending heroin dealers and you get poor results, you could develop a set of enemies.
You could. And in fact, there were instances where he actually did have some threats.
And Laura Lebowski knew her sister Peggy had always been concerned about the high risks that attended her husband's work as a criminal defense attorney.
Carlos and Peggy did get pretty reliable threats. And I know that they had very elaborate lock-in systems and whatever on their house.
She bolted herself in at night.
Yeah. She said, well, in Carlos's line of work, you know, he gets threats and stuff, and we're just, you know, kind of cautious.
But now all of Carlos and Peggy's precautions were for naught. Detective Mark Simmons got the call that Saturday night that there'd been a double shooting in the upscale bedroom community he served.
What kinds of crimes are you usually called to investigate?
I would say mostly property crimes, burglary, theft, larceny, criminal mischief, drunk driving, and so forth.
So when you get a call of gunshot victims?
That's unusual.
Detective Simmons raced to the hospital. The first thing he sees is the Mitsubishi rammed into the guard post.
All four doors were open. The car had blood in it. There was a noticeable bullet hole in the window. There was a shell casing sitting on the back seat. There was a black coat sitting on the back seat with a white plastic bag protruding from within the folds of the coat.
First glance observations, little that explained itself.
I don't have very many facts at this point other than to ask the person who was involved what happened.
Detective Simmons was led into Carlos's hospital room. Carlos told him about the ambush.
The person had gotten into his vehicle, into the back seat, with a weapon, and he attempted to take that weapon from the assailant, during which time shots were fired in the car.
Yes, he's telling it to you. Does it make sense to you?
Is it plausible? Well, yes. He tells me, you know, he's an attorney, that he's represented various clients, some of which weren't happy.
And he's got some tough characters he's represented.
Absolutely.
People that might be out for revenge because they thought they got a raw deal.
Absolutely.
The police worked through the night collecting bits and pieces of evidence from the SUV and from the general roadside area where Carlos had described the ambush taking place.
They found blood on the road and a shell casing was located there as well.
So that was X marks the spot of where this took place, huh?
Basically, yes.
Merced finally arrived at the airport.
When I got there, my brother, his best friend, and my best friend were there waiting for me in the baggage claim. And, you know, I knew right away that my mother had died pretty much.
The facts were overwhelming. His mother dead from a gunshot wound to the head. His father shot, lying wounded in a hospital bed. Merced paced the corridor while he waited to see his father.
Yeah, finally let me in, and he burst out crying, you know, and he was like, yeah, you know, I'm sorry, I couldn't protect her.
Did he tell you anything about the incident itself at that point, Merced?
No, he was just crying. I mean, he looked skinny, he looked pale. I mean, he was shot in his stomach, and from what I was told by the doctors and stuff, it had been an inch to the side. It would hit a major artery and killed him.
From his hospital bed, Carlos told the police the details he could remember.
Did he have a make, model, color of the vehicle?
Yes, there was a Toyota-like vehicle, and he described it as boxy, not rounded as the newer models are.
Has he given you a description of the assailant?
He did say he was Hispanic.
Detective Simmons summoned a sketch artist to the hospital. Carlos described an olive-skinned man, maybe Colombian, scruffy, wearing a baseball cap and jeans. As an experienced criminal defense attorney, he urged investigators to get the sketch out immediately before the gunman disappeared.
When I gave him the sketch, I also told him, look, if this is a hit, because they're the ones that started asking me if I had gotten threats of this and the other. I said, if this is some kind of a hit, this guy's going to be out of the country.
even as the police released the sketch to the local media and gave them some details of the crime.
Now, it's not clear if they were victims of road rage or a calculated ambush.
The shocking news was filtering out to Peggy's large family spread all across the country.
My sister Joanne called me, and I just picked up the phone, and she was quiet for a minute. She goes, "Peggy's dead. She's been shot." And she was just pretty hysterical. And I was just, you know, dumbfounded.
The family had the sketchiest of details about the roadside ambush, but it sounded to them like a revenge killing rooted in Carlos's criminal defense practice.
We were concerned that, you know, somebody was unhappy with him and had ordered a hit.
And now the family had even more to worry about. Would the hitman return to finish the job? Peggy Perez Olivo had been murdered on a Westchester roadside. Her family and friends gathered to say their goodbyes. At the funeral, Alicia remembers thinking a small urn of ashes was all that remained of her mother. Alicia was at childhood's end.
This was my time to be a grown-up. This was the first time that I had to pull myself together and take care of people.
Alicia became an adult.
Yeah, that was the day.
The detective, Mark Simmons, was among the mourners.
A detective and I went to the memorial service.
What do you expect to get in that kind of thing?
You know, try to pay a little respect. I mean, you are now going to be charged with investigating the death of this woman. But you do watch. You watch to see who's there, to see if, and you never know, you're going to be around people that may have info to share with you.
The police so far had turned up nothing. No older Toyota, no Colombian with a baseball cap. At the house after the funeral, Carlos could not stop talking about the shooting.
The one way he put it to me was the one time in his life that he was called on to protect Peggy and he failed. And, you know, it was a lot of, if I had this, if I had that, if I hadn't, you know, fought with the gunman, you know, second guessing himself. But
he felt guilty about your sister's death.
And he was just destroyed. He had nightmares. He couldn't sleep.
Restless nights, bleak days. The father Alicia knew was gone.
He wasn't there. He just wasn't. Part of him just died. My mom made him whole. Tried to give me a hug, but he couldn't really move because of the shot wound. And after that, it was just a very, very different. My life was turned upside down for sure.
Peggy's sister, Laura Lebowski, did what she could to help her brother-in-law.
He had a room off of the kitchen, and he had a rocking chair, and he would just sit in the corner. And people would go in and, you know, spend time sitting with him. If he felt like talking, we would talk. And if he, you know, just wanted to sit and stare out into space, that's pretty much what he did.
Just staring.
And just crying. Carlos was, he was in agony. I mean, there's just no way to describe the grief.
Merced, who'd always been particularly close to his mom, tried to comfort his father while confronting his own grief.
No one ever loved you the way your mother does, you know, and I feel like I had like a support beam taken out from underneath me.
Alicia was having a hard time even accepting that her mother was dead.
For a long time afterwards, I believed that my mom was still going to pull into the driveway and that it was a bad TV show prank. I was like, this is not true. This wouldn't happen to my family. My family's the perfect family. That's what my friends say. It wouldn't happen to us.
As the family struggled with grief in the days after the funeral, they were also on edge that the killer might come back to finish the job. So much so that Frank Farullo, a former college football player, spent the first week sleeping at the end of Carlos's bed.
I was just concerned for his general safety. I slept at the foot of the bed, and one of his friends actually slept out in the hallway because we weren't sure whether or not this was a hit or not.
So you're a big guy. If someone was going to come back, they'd have to get past you to get to him.
Right.
3 days after the shooting, as friends and family kept their round-the-clock vigil in the house, Carlos, barely functional in his grief, offered to speak to the detectives alone as he sat in his bedroom wearing his bathrobe.
I told him, I know you have to look at the husband first. So, you know, talk to anybody you want. You want the names of the people that we know? Here are the names, you know, talk to them. Because I want you to realize that there is no reason why I would do this. There's absolutely no reason.
And yet, the detectives were soon to discover there may be plenty of reasons to look at Carlos Perez Olivo. Starting with his precarious situation as an out-of-work attorney with lots of bills piling up. There was also a big insurance policy on his wife, Peggy. It was falling to the police officers of this small community in Westchester County, New York, to determine what had happened on a darkened roadway in their town where things like this just never happened. Carlos Perez Olivo had told the police a horrifying story. After a night out in Manhattan, he and his wife had been ambushed by a gunman. She was shot in the head, fatally. He was shot in the stomach. 12 days after the shooting, Carlos Perez Olivo agreed to accompany the detectives to New York City to retrace the route of where he'd gone on that Saturday of the shooting.
I had nothing to hide.
Detective Simmons and his partner picked up Carlos at his house.
He said, take us the way you went. And he did. And we drove down to the city. Initially, when he got in the car, he had a pen. And he was clicking the pen, click, 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 like this.
Why'd that strike you?
Well, I just wondered, are you nervous? Are you upset? What's causing you to do that?
When they returned to Westchester, Detective Simmons asked Carlos to guide them to the spot where the ambush occurred.
We recovered items from that scene where we think this at least occurred. Initially, we went past that spot and he stopped us and I said, no, we're too far north. I turned around and we started back up again. And he stopped us, no, I'm too far south. So we played for a little while in that area until he finally settled on where he thinks this occurred.
This is a long, dark stretch of road.
At this point, I'm wondering if he doesn't know. But as we got up to the area where we believe this occurred, he started to click and lock and unlock the electric door locks in the car.
Maybe if Carlos was edgy, it was because of a secret he'd disclosed to the detectives the day before. He told the investigators that he knew they'd look for a girlfriend and that they would find one.
He brings that to our attention. That's how we first learn of this woman.
It was an affair with a younger woman he had met in Puerto Rico, and it had lasted for a decade.
It was, in a sense, out of character. I had never looked at another woman for the first 20 years that I'd been married. I don't know. My wife didn't deserve it. I have no excuse.
Was she current tense in your life?
No, we had stopped about 2 years or 2.5 years or a year and a half before. And it was like an on and off situation. And I had always basically told her, look, you know, I'm married, I have children, I'm not going to break up my family.
Yet some months before the shooting, he said the lover had called to say she'd married and had a baby. They resumed as phone friends.
We talked maybe once every 2 weeks or 3 weeks, you'd call her.
The day of the shooting, it would turn out, was also the former lover's birthday. Carlos had sent his old flame flowers.
I did. I had not sent her anything the year or 2 years before that. I always would send her flowers. And I chose to do it that time because we had talked every so often. And I felt that as a friend, it was a goodwill kind of gesture.
Carlos had called the woman from the city hours before the shooting to see if she'd gotten the flowers.
So now you have a wife who's been shot to death and a man who's telling you that he has a lover who's maybe past tense, but this is a classic part of a homicide case.
Well, it was a long-term affair, 10 years. Whether or not it was concluded when he said he did, But so, yeah, that adds an element to this. It adds an element to this.
Not good facts for a man with a murdered wife and no sign of the assailant from the back seat. But to Carlos, it was as meaningless as it was only circumstantial. He, of all people, a criminal defense attorney, would never be that stupid.
I mean, stop and think about it, okay? I mean, you think I'm going to send an ex-girlfriend, or if she is a girlfriend, flowers the night I'm supposed to go and kill my wife? It'd be the stupidest thing to do, okay? I mean, you know. And I'm the one that told the police. I said, look, I sent flowers, blah, blah, blah. You're not going to find, I made a phone call that night. You're not going to find it on the phone because I used a card that I had that I used to call outside the country.
His friend Robert Buckley knew all about the girlfriend and shrugged it off.
A number of us knew of the affair. We knew when it ended. It had been over 18 months before the incident.
And yet, right at the time of the crime, he sends her birthday flowers.
She was still a friend.
Do you believe it was a hot and heavy ongoing thing?
Absolutely not. The affair was sex. It wasn't the kind of relationship that Carlos and Becky had.
Does it say, therefore, the marriage was unhappy?
No. It says that at that point in the marriage, as people get older, as women change, interests in their sex life changes. He would never leave Peggy. Never leave Peggy.
Laura Lebowski doesn't know whether her sister knew about a girlfriend or not, but she wasn't shocked to learn that there was one. One thing everyone seemed to know about Carlos was how much he doted on women.
He loved women, and Carlos needed, you know, he was a person who liked attention and affection, and I don't know what was going on in their lives, but it just didn't surprise me that Carlos would have somebody to fulfill needs if he felt he needed more attention than he was getting.
But while the adults could maybe understand it in the big picture context of a 30-year marriage, the news hit his son hard.
I wasn't happy to find that out.
Were you mad at your dad?
Yeah, I was very mad with him.
But while Carlos admittedly may not have been a model husband, no one could say he wasn't cooperating fully with the police, laying out his imperfections, giving them potential leads, trying to help. Carlos even suggested that he offer a $100,000 reward to anyone with information leading to the arrest of his wife's killer. And he pushed the detectives to wire him up to a polygraph.
Give me a lie detector test. I don't care.
You'd be willing to take one anytime.
I have nothing to hide. I have nothing to hide.
The detectives decided not to give Carlos a polygraph since they can't be used in New York State courtrooms. But they also didn't need a lie detector test to tell them that there were strengths in Carlos's account of an unknown armed assailant. Chief among the reasons to believe him, he'd taken a shot himself. And there was a long-as-your-arm roster of former clients who potentially might want to settle a score with Carlos. From the outset, detectives had wondered whether Peggy Perez Olivo was a wrong-time, wrong-place victim of a hitman. Someone intent on taking out her husband for getting sideways with one of the tough customers he'd represented. And Buckley, who'd worked briefly with Carlos in his law practice, told detectives that they might want to check out one of them from a recent high-profile case that the two had worked on together. A man named Elio Cruz believed Carlos had botched his defense when he got sentenced to prison for killing his wife's lover. Had Cruz hired a hitman from his prison cell as payback?
You believe that he had made a threat directly against Carlos and his family?
I had been told that he did.
So maybe the mystery of what happened out on that dark roadway might be explained by talking to Elliot Cruz.
Yes.
Prior to the shooting, Carlos says he heard that Cruz was trying to even the score.
I got a call from an ex-client telling me that he had overheard conversations afterwards of Mr. Cruz saying that he was going to ruin my life like his life was ruined.
Detective Simmons chased down that lead.
What he told us is that both he and his family were very unhappy with the outcome of the case.
Hey, maybe.
Absolutely.
But detectives had hopes of a breakthrough in the case. They didn't have the murder weapon, but there was a large lake right near where the ambush had taken place. Had the gunman thrown the firearm into it? Police divers were assembled for a what-do-we-have-to-lose kind of search. The shoulder of the road where Carlos said a gunman shot him and killed his wife is just yards from the bank of a good-sized lake.
Here's a body of water. It's a perfect place to get rid of a gun.
New York State Trooper Christian McCarthy's dive team was dispatched to the lakeside on little more than the homicide detective's hunch. Check out the lake.
We were just told that there was a murder weapon that was missing, and it might be in here.
The lake was covered with ice and snow when we asked the trooper to meet us and tell us about that search his dive team made 4 days after Peggy's death. Their point of reference was the spot on the shoulder where blood drops had been found. Had the killer perhaps tossed the gun from that very place?
The thought being that if somebody got out of their car, that might be where they threw the gun, right there, rather than walking up and down the road or driving to another location.
As they've done on hundreds of investigations, the divers mapped out a grid with lines coming back to the ground zero of the blood drop and plunged into the murky lake.
Once you hit the bottom, the silt gets mucked up and you're in a cloud of silt and you just can't see anything, not even an inch. It's total blackness.
Finding a handgun mired in a silty bottom, if it even existed, struck the veteran divers as long odds. They figured they'd be days searching the grids.
I would say it's astronomical, the odds of us finding it.
As Trooper McCarthy kicked his way just above the bottom, he trailed a gloved hand, finding stones, muck. Then, there it was, the heft.
I held it up out of the silt, and I'm staring at a handgun. I was amazed. It was a needle in a haystack, and now I'm looking at what might be a murder weapon.
Very lucky day of diving, huh?
Very lucky day.
Amazingly, they'd retrieved a gun, an old semi-automatic. But was it the gun used to murder Peggy? That was a question only the experts could answer. Tony Tota did the ballistics work for Westchester County at the time. In the homicide of Peggy Perez Olivo, he now had three valuable things to compare. The actual bullet slug the medical examiner had removed from the victim's head, spent shell casings found at the scene, and the mystery gun fished out of the nearby lake. Tota always examined the gun in question and fired a sample round, standard procedure to help him make his findings.
That was the weapon that produced those shell casings.
And you can say that with a certainty out a lot of decimal points.
Oh, absolutely.
This weapon fired this bullet.
I have no wavering factor to when I say it's the firearm, it's the firearm.
The needle in a haystack recovery of the handgun and the ballistic test finding that it was definitively the murder weapon was a major breakthrough.
How huge is this for your case at this point?
Well, it's huge. I couldn't have hoped or imagined that in a million years. So we now have the murder weapon.
And then you've got to put the murder weapon in somebody's hands.
With his initial interviews concluded, the detective stepped back to look at the big picture of his case. And there was a part of the husband's story he didn't quite get. Something common sense, really. And it had to do with going down out-of-the-way roads looking for gas.
It did strike me as odd to get gas there to save, I think, what was kind of a nominal amount per gallon.
He had to go out of his way to save a few cents, huh?
It seems a bit odd having been in the city at a fairly, not an inexpensive dinner, just an hour before. Struck me as odd.
As the detective speculated on the hitman revenge theory of the crime, how was it that the assailant knew Carlos would be on that stretch of highway where he said he was overtaken, miles from his home?
If you're going to lay in wait for somebody, you have to pretty much know where they're going to be and when.
It only made sense if the husband had been followed. So Simmons found security camera pictures documenting parts of Carlos and Peggy's day in New York.
Looking to see video, what's the demeanor? What are you seeing on that camera? Is somebody following them?
The video shows the couple entering a theater, but there isn't anyone obviously casing them.
Didn't see anybody lurking in the back or apparently following them. We had video of them both purchasing the tickets, walking through the theater, waiting outside, I believe, the bathroom at one point, then walking into the movie theater. It was fairly unremarkable footage, just a man and his wife at a movie.
And coming home at the toll booth, the camera doesn't record a vaguely older Japanese car following them. Detective Simmons spent hours analyzing the video from that night.
Looking at a video, you can't tell if somebody's following somebody or not. There's a constant flow of vehicles through a New York City toll barrier on a Saturday night.
Though the detective noted with interest, there was a car matching that description ahead of them at the toll plaza.
What I did see is a car, a boxy, kind of Toyota, four-door, similar to the one described to us.
Could one of those cars have belonged to the gunman? But the detective was also learning more about that backseat struggle Carlos had related in some detail. Arm wrestling the man for the gun over the front seat console, ending up himself in the rear of the vehicle.
We saw no evidence of any footprints or scuff marks across the dashboard or the seats. We also found on the back of the car, there was a newspaper on the floor of the passenger side rear where this assailant got in. But the newspaper wasn't torn or stepped on. It didn't look like it had been disturbed.
It didn't look as though there had been a struggle in this back seat.
Well, it didn't. And again, remembering that the coat was still sitting in the center of the seat with this bag coming out of it, still on the seat in the middle. Two people had slid out their car. It almost seems to me that would have been dragged out onto the floor or at least out the side of the vehicle. But that wasn't the case.
The county crime scene techs had also analyzed scorching from the muzzle blast, measured the angles of the bullet's trajectories, and mapped out the blood spatter. And what they found wasn't matching Carlos's account of the struggle.
It just didn't seem possible to for the sequence of shots to have occurred the way he described them.
Start with Peggy, the victim. The ME determined that the gun had been fired right near the back of her head. The bullet went straight and true, not angled up or down. An amazing shot for a gun being wildly fought over.
The medical examiner tells me that, in his opinion, the bullet that struck and killed her was fired from about an inch from the back of her head and was straight and level.
Another bullet went into the fabric beneath the roof. The angle of entry dictated to the county ballistics experts where the gun had been when it was fired.
When they looked at the angle of entry of that bullet hole, it appears to be coming from towards the outside of the car rather than inside the car.
Another bullet shattered a rear glass panel. The angle told the county's experts it was fired straight into the glass like Peggy's fatal wound.
My findings were that that hole in that glass was straight on, 90 degrees.
It was hard for investigators to understand how that same bullet could go through the side of Carlos's stomach during the struggle and then continue through the car window, exiting at a clean 90-degree angle.
It seems like it would be impossible to get yourself up into that position where that bullet could go through him and then go through that glass at the angle and height that it did.
Other questions. Carlos's overcoat folded on the back seat. Sticking out of the pocket was a small white garbage bag. Inside the bag, crime scene analysts found gunshot residue.
It seemed that that was a tremendously high concentration of gunpowder residue inside that.
My totally non-expert brain could see gunshots being fired in a contained area and it's raining down particles of something that's going to be detectable to the lab.
For it to get down inside, in a pocket, in a bag, down in there, in the concentration that it did, is very difficult.
There was so much that didn't add up to the detective. Peggy, as Carlos told it, had remained snoozing as this fight in a confined space broke out. Carlos Perez Olivo, despite his willingness to take a lie detector test, wasn't entirely eliminating himself as a suspect. After all, there was the admitted former girlfriend of many years.
It's hard to speculate, but it's also impossible to discount the coincidence that the night Peggy dies is this woman's birthday.
But the detective also knew that if sex and passion are very often part of the mix in domestic murders, then so often is money. And now the investigators began the tedious paper chase of tracking down the Perez Olivo's finances. What jumped out at them was how little cash on hand Carlos apparently had. The family banking account was down to the last $300, and the investigators believe he hadn't told his children or even his wife Peggy the monumental news that he had been disbarred.
His sole means of making money and supporting himself and his lifestyle and his family's lifestyle is now gone.
This is an enormous fact in a relationship of 30 years.
Absolutely.
My ticket's been pulled to practice law, and this is how we make our money.
Absolutely.
The children didn't know.
I don't believe that they knew.
And the wife didn't know, Peggy.
That's what we believe. She didn't know.
With his livelihood gone, no money was coming in that the detectives could see, but the bills kept piling up.
We got a financial picture of people that, on the surface, seemed to have money. Beautiful home, beautiful community, a wealthy suburb. But when you delve deeper, you find that, okay, he doesn't own the home. Rents the home. Okay, you don't own this car, they're leased. Bills are late. Credit cards are not paid, and then new credit cards are open. You start to see a financial picture of people that may be living beyond their means.
And then they came upon the life insurance policies, Peggy's.
What we found was that while Mr. Perez Olivo was by all accounts the primary supporter and breadwinner, he had fairly low amount of insurance on himself. But we found that there were approximately five policies that had Ms. Perez Olivo as the insured, where the payout was somewhere in the area of $850,000 to $875,000.
She's making maybe $25,000 a year with a wind at her back in a good year.
If that, as a teacher's aide.
And she's got a $900,000 payout policy on her.
Right. We also found that the policies on Ms. Perez Olivo had had the payouts increased somewhere in the area of 04 and 05.
The investigation was a year old. On the anniversary of Peggy's death, Alicia and her older brother Carlitos took the urn with her mother's ashes to the beach.
It was a beautiful day, and it was time to really think about my mom just as a person, not as a victim, not as anything like that, just my mom.
And then, a few weeks later, Carlos had something to tell Alicia, by then a senior in high school.
In 20 minutes, the police were going to be coming to arrest him. He told me that money's over here, you know, use this money to pay the bills, get food, and, you know, you're a big girl now, you can take care of yourself.
The investigators had put together a picture of a failing Lothario in late middle age, disgraced in his career, tapped out at the bank, unable to keep up the good suburban happy family facade. Killing his wife for the insurance money, they theorized, was the solution to his problems. From the upstairs bedroom, Alicia pushed aside the curtain to watch the detectives take her father away.
I don't know why I did that. That was kind of a bad memory, but they pushed him up against the car and they took him away. And I was left there.
Carlos Perez Olivo was charged with the murder of his wife, Peggy. Carlos Perez Olivo was now on trial for shooting his wife to death on a darkened suburban road as they drove home from Manhattan.
When it comes to this guy, the evidence will show that what may at first appear perfect is not.
The prosecutors believe Perez Olivo was a man in a personal tsunami and saw killing his wife as the solution to his problems.
Mr. Perez Olivo, without any doubt in my mind, planned the murder execution of his wife.
So he went to New York knowing full well that he was going to kill her on a dark road.
Knowing full well he would kill her on a dark road.
Janet DeFiore, then the Westchester County District Attorney, believes that Perez Olivo was all but dead broke with a lifestyle in an affluent suburb he could no longer afford to keep up.
The payoff of the insurance policy provides motivation with a capital M.
Money and another woman. The former mistress of many years he'd sent flowers to and called on the very day his wife was murdered.
What does that tell you about the perfect family?
In court, the big picture the prosecution team was trying to draw for the jury was of a desperate man coming unraveled, the secret compartments of his life breaking open.
This was a man who obviously was a very narcissistic person. And after all, he was disbarred for stealing money from his clients. He showed that in his relationship with his wife before he murdered her by being involved with another woman. This was a man who elevated his own self-interest above all those around him.
Carlos's story was that he and his wife were run off the road on a Saturday night in November, and a gunman climbed in the backseat of their car. There was a struggle for the gun, as Carlos told it. Shots fired, killing Peggy, wounding him.
Roll him.
The investigators made a video demonstration of the sequence of events as he told it to them.
I'm jammed against here. This knee is jammed against here.
Right.
In the confined interior of the Mitsubishi, they couldn't understand how Carlos ended up in the back seat as he struggled for the gun with only the narrow opening of the console to get there.
He can't get back here without this thing popping up.
There is no way imaginable that Mr. Perez Olivo could have gotten through the space in between the seats. The space as measured was 9 inches, and he would have you believe that he is tussling with the assailant in the back seat, and he gets into the back seat of the car. Not possible.
Well, his knee is in my side.
Right.
And what's more, to believe Carlos's version of events, the prosecutor argued, he would have clambered into the back seat without ever waking up his wife beside him.
I think it defies common sense that if you are in the passenger compartment and your husband's in a struggle for his life and your life, that you're not aroused in some way. Very unusual and highly unlikely.
And the prosecutors thought the very fact that Carlos drove to the hospital instead of waiting for EMTs to come to him was also part of his master plan.
He needed to get away from the exact location of the murder because he tossed the gun not far from the location of the murder. He wanted to divert the police away from that location so that they wouldn't recover the gun.
Because if the crime scene moves, it makes it all that much more difficult for the investigators, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
And something caught their eyes as they played back that security camera video taken when Carlos arrived at the hospital.
His shirt was tucked into his pants. This is a man who had just claimed that he was in a life and death struggle for his and his wife's life, and he's arriving at the hospital a few short minutes later with his shirt tucked into his pants and looking perfectly neat and trim.
And if it was a professional hit or even a carjacking, why, the prosecutor asked, would the gunman put himself in a vulnerable position in the back seat of Carlos's Mitsubishi?
What common sense tells you, if this were a carjacker, as Mr. Perez Olivo offered to us, the carjacker wouldn't get into the back seat. He'd yank you out of the front seat of the car and get in the car and take the car. He didn't do that.
So if you get into the back seat of the car, you're in an unsafe area if you're the perpetrator.
You've lost all control virtually, and there would be no reason. What would be the advantage for the perpetrator to get into the back seat of the car? None.
And perhaps most importantly to the prosecutor, also from a common sense point of view, was if this was a professional hit or a carjacking, why would the gunman kill the wife and leave the husband an eyewitness with little more than a treat and release wound?
The assailant leaves the car?
And he leaves.
With the male with a very minor wound and the female dead, does that make sense?
Of course that doesn't make any sense.
If you're a robber, if you're the hitman.
If you were the carjacker, you'd take the car.
No.
And if you were the hitman, you'd shoot him dead.
And that didn't happen.
And that did not happen.
Suspicions about the husband's story. But they'd need much more than that if they were going to convince a jury that Carlos Perez Olivo killed his wife. Why would this seemingly happy 30-year marriage end in a morgue?
This is a family not unlike many others in Westchester.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Very good appearance, accomplished.
They did appear to be a loving couple. But, you know, there's no telling what goes on behind people's closed doors.
So investigators started pushing those doors open, looking into deeper psychological terrain. They saw a man who had been at one time hospitalized with clinical depression and who'd now lost his ability to practice law. He'd been disbarred, a disgrace they believe he'd concealed from his family.
Practice was done over. There was no apparent means of income.
What the prosecutor saw left was the life insurance on her. $900,000 wasn't a fortune by Chappaqua standards, but enough, the authorities figured, for Carlos to set himself up for the next chapter in his life. Perhaps with the old girlfriend he'd sent flowers to that day. There'd be no costly divorce for him. A movie and dinner date in New York, followed by a bullet to the brain, would be the way out.
All part of a plan, a very devious and diabolical plan to commit murder and get away with it.
But this case would turn out to have a star witness having to do with that very handgun the divers had retrieved from the lake.
How often do the legal gods give you a witness like that?
It's unbelievable. It's the gun, the gun, the gun.
The court was about to hear from the prosecution's star witness. His testimony would be about the vintage German handgun used to kill Peggy that divers had fished out of the roadside lake.
That's the gun. I mean, there was no mistaking it.
Mark Gazzola would tell the court that he'd seen the distinctive Walther PPK semi-automatic inside Carlos's house 5 months before Peggy was murdered. His story starts back in June of 2006. Carlos and Peggy were renters boxing up for yet another house move. Mark Gazzola was helping out his uncle, the Perez Olivo's landlord, in making sure that the tenants had left the property in broom-swept condition. He found the house was anything but packed up.
Boxes were in the living room. Furniture was still there. It was chaos.
So Gazzola made a distress call to his father to come help him get these tenants out quickly because the house had been sold.
We started upstairs. We started sweeping floors.
As they worked their way through the bedrooms, his father noticed a partly opened manila envelope.
He saw a gun inside of it. So he called my attention. I turned around and we look, and it was a pistol that was on the floor.
Did you know what it is?
Absolutely, yeah, absolutely. I have a pistol permit. I know my firearms. It was a German Walther PPK.
No doubt in your mind?
No, not at all.
The pistol in question is one that some collectors like Mark Gazzola keep their eyes out for. The Walther PPK is known as the James Bond gun and has a certain cachet. Gazzola said he went downstairs and asked Carlos to come up to the bedroom.
As we're walking up the stairs, I tell him we found a pistol in the closet. Oh, yeah, that's his pistol. We walk into the bedroom. I walk up to him. He picks up the firearm. He and I are both looking at it. He's handling it for me. He says, "Hey, do you know what this is?" I said, "Sure, that's a German Walter PPK." He says, "You know what it's famous for?" "Yeah, James Bond movies." We go back and forth, small talk about the firearm.
Gazzola, it turned out, had been shopping around for a Walther PPK, and the pistol Carlos was holding was exactly what he'd been looking for.
I tell him that I was actually interested in purchasing that firearm. I said, "Listen, would you love to sell it? I'd love to buy it from you."
Carlos, he said, answered that the gun had sentimental value, something about it being a gift from a client, and he wasn't interested in selling it. End of the conversation. Back to sweeping out the house.
A night out in Manhattan ends in violence and gunfire for a Westchester couple.
Then that November weekend, it was all over the news. That ambush shooting of Carlos and Peggy Perez Olivo.
My immediate response was I felt horrible. I felt bad. I just helped them clean up. I knew her. She was nice. She made me something to drink while I was at the house.
As he followed the news of the shootings, Mark Gazzola told his coworkers about that June day when he saw the gun in the Perez Olivo home.
I went into work and I said, "You know, if they ever turn up with a German Walter PPK, I have to come forward and I have to say something."
And lo and behold, divers fish out from that lake.
A German Walter PPK.
In the courtroom, the prosecutor saw him as an unshakable witness. He spoke with encyclopedic certainty about Walther PPKs.
He was an extraordinary witness. As luck would have it, he was a gun enthusiast, very familiar with that particular gun, and in fact, searching for that particular gun.
And Mark Gazzola identified for the jury the murder weapon as the very gun he saw in the Perez Olivo house that day.
Is the gun in evidence the very same one that you saw at the house that day?
Sure, yeah. That's the German Walther PPK I saw.
Not close, not like it, not sort of.
That was the one that I wanted to buy.
Carlos dismissed Mark Gazzola's story altogether. No way could he have seen a Walther PPK in his house.
You think he's lying? He's making the story up.
I don't think he's lying. I know he's lying.
He did not see that distinctive gun in your house.
He couldn't have seen that gun because there was no gun in the house. I don't like guns. I've never had any guns. There have never been any guns in the house. The only thing that was in the house that looked like a gun was a pellet gun that looks quite similar to what that gun looked like.
Do you think the guy that came to your house today saw that?
I know that's what they saw.
A pellet gun?
Yes, that looks like a real gun, but it's not.
Our discussion was not of a pellet gun. It was a German Walther PPK.
Are you sure it wasn't a pellet gun you saw?
Absolutely. It was definitely not a pellet gun.
The gun. The story of a troubled marriage and teetering finances. The defense had its work cut out for it. But Carlos Perez Olivo, a one-time criminal defense lawyer who'd represented clients accused of murder, would fight back with all he had.
Did you murder your wife, Peggy?
Of course not. If there was any way that I could change places with her, if there was any way that I could be dead, I'd be very happy.
Their case has been nothing more than innuendo and speculation.
The defense was up, and it had to undo the prosecution's damaging version of the story of Peggy's murder.
Just not credible, just not believable. He has no idea what he saw.
Defense attorney Christopher McClure took on the biggest problem. Mark Gazzola's testimony about seeing the murder weapon in Carlos's hand 5 months before his wife was murdered. Was it funny, posed the defense, that anyone could have such a vast knowledge about the Walther PPK at their fingertips, the way Gazzola seemed to on the stand?
The question is, when did he learn that? Did he learn it from Wikipedia 2 weeks before trial? Did he learn it a month before trial? No one knows when he learned that.
And co-defense attorney Richard Portale would also try to poke holes in the forensic evidence, starting with that reconstruction demonstration.
I don't have enough room over here.
It didn't contradict Carlos's account, the defense team argued, because significantly, it failed to take into account the position of the driver's seat during the struggle. They argued the seat was pushed back further at the time of the shooting, leaving enough room for Carlos to be dragged into the back of the Mitsubishi.
The seats were not placed in the same position that they were in at the time of the incident.
The prosecutors had argued that Peggy was shot at close range with the gun put beneath the space of her headrest. But the defense said that was just one possible scenario.
Their claim that the muzzle of the gun was under the headrest, and that was not supported by
any of the forensics, any of the gunshot residue pattern analysis that we had done.
And they pointed out to the jurors, don't forget, Carlos himself had been shot.
It was a wound to the stomach. And it went in, fortunately, it went in and out, but even their own doctor testified there are major organs around there.
And the defense team pointed out that Carlos could have been shot in the stomach during the struggle with the gunman, with that same bullet exiting the rear window.
We actually introduced an anatomically correct doll with a dowel going in and out of the doll and out the hole in the window to show that it was certainly possible.
And to further prove its point that someone else was in the car that night, the defense pointed out that investigators had found some male hair that didn't belong to Carlos in the backseat area of the Mitsubishi, as well as other DNA they couldn't trace.
They found a substantial amount of blood in the backseat. They just couldn't link it to anybody.
And the defense lawyers also believed that the police had failed to fully investigate Carlos's former client, Helio Cruz.
There are witnesses that claim they heard him make statements indicating that Mr. Cruz believed that Carlos threw his case, that he knew everything about Mr. Presolivo. He knew where he lived. I think the quote was, when he's dead, send me the press clippings upstate so I can laugh.
So maybe this was what, a hitman? Somebody hired by a guy with a major beef against your client?
What we do know is Mr. Presolivo represented a lot of people that are capable of such acts.
But Detective Simmons chased down the Helio Cruz lead and came away convinced that he had nothing whatsoever to do with the shooting.
Could he arrange a hit from prison?
I don't know if it's as easy to do as maybe movies or television have it portrayed to do, but we did pursue that angle, but we're unable to corroborate that this individual was able to mastermind this.
But perhaps the most important point the defense wanted the jury to take away was that Carlos Perez Olivo's family and friends believed that he was incapable of killing Peggy, the woman he loved, the mother of his three children.
I know he didn't kill my mother. If I thought for a second that my father had to do anything with my mother being killed, I would not for a second be supporting him or defending him. And I am defending him because I'm 100% sure there's no way he could have done this.
His sister Alicia is equally emphatic.
There's just no possible way. That's ridiculous. The DA is nothing. They have nothing.
Peggy's own sister even testified on behalf of her brother-in-law.
I can't say Carlos is a perfect guy. He had an affair. He had money troubles. He's been disbarred. I can't say he's a model citizen. But just because you do all those things, that doesn't make you a murderer. No matter what you think of Carlos as a person, I knew that there was no way that he killed my sister.
But what would a jury think?
You know, we tried to understand the marriage, and here's a guy who says he loves his wife, but he had a mistress for a number of years. He told the detectives that he went to escort services. I mean, it wasn't quite the picture that he was trying to paint.
In the courthouse, the case was now in the hands of the jury. District Attorney DeFiore was confident it would be a guilty verdict.
I think if anyone sat through that trial that took place in this courthouse, that there would be absolutely no doubt that Carlos Perez Olivo murdered his wife in cold blood.
And that's all we could ask for.
But defense attorney McClure felt just as strongly there was no way a jury could convict based on the evidence.
They speculated the entire trial as to what happened. And you can't convict somebody on speculation.
But of course, the stakes were highest for Carlos Perez Olivo. If the verdict was a gamble, his life was what was at stake. As a veteran criminal defense attorney, he knew exactly what he was up against.
You've waited for a lot of juries to come back. How strange was it for you to be waiting for a jury to come back?
Bizarre is the only way to describe it. It's like sometimes I feel like, you know, I'm somebody and I'm looking at something that's happened to somebody else because it just doesn't make sense.
But now a jury of 12 would decide his fate. They included an IT director, a customer service supervisor, a marketing project manager, a housewife, an auto mechanic, an IT manager, a phone company worker, a retired executive, and an MRI technician.
But
I felt that we were all keeping an open mind.
In a circumstantial case with no eyewitnesses, no confession to the crime, the jury was going to have to work its way through the evidence piece by piece. They started by debating the central question. Would Carlos Perez Olivo, one-time successful lawyer, father of three, brutally kill his wife of 30 years?
This is sort of a dilemma for you because everything on the exterior from the sidewalk before you peel away the roof seems to be pretty good. They've been together for a long time.
But inside, there was something else going on.
You got a sense that, this is a family that was, despite their what appeared to be a kind of wealthy lifestyle, was really kind of one, you know, one event away from being completely bankrupt.
In addition to the family's money problems, Carlos had also carried on a decade-long affair, even sending the woman flowers for her birthday and calling her the night his wife was shot to see if she'd gotten them.
If nothing else, what it showed was this wasn't the idyllic marriage that the defense tried to paint. This was somebody who clearly wasn't entirely happy with his wife.
But Carlos, a former criminal defense attorney, had been disbarred just 3 months before the murder. Had one of his angry clients ambushed him by the side of the road? Was this a revenge killing?
He defended tough guys. He defended drug dealers and, you know, people who may have been in organized crime.
Did you have to consider whether his practice defending tough guys might have come back to haunt him?
I thought about it.
It was a story that you could imagine might be true.
Maybe there really was a hitman.
So you had to consider that?
Oh, absolutely. Definitely considered that.
It was more the fact that he was a criminal defense lawyer and that he defended people that perhaps were disgruntled and were looking to get back at him. I mean, there are situations where you don't have happy customers, and if those unhappy customers are criminals, you gotta factor that in a little bit.
And remember, Peggy's own sister, as well as her children, had taken the stand to say there was no way their father had killed their mother.
For me, that was a tough emotional thing to get by, in thinking that, gosh, these kids love their dad so much. How could he do this?
Maybe because he didn't do it, huh?
Absolutely.
But the jurors were also going to have to take a hard look at the forensics of the case. The angle of the bullets. The size and shape of the Mitsubishi. Could the struggle in the car with the gunman have happened the way Carlos described it? The jury was prepared for a long deliberation. The jury deliberated late into the night, and the longer they were out, the more confident the defense team was that they would find their client, Carlos Perez Olivo, not guilty.
I can just say that we're encouraged by the fact that they are looking at the case carefully, which is what we could ask for them to do, looking at the evidence, and we think they'll come to the right decision of a not guilty verdict.
Upstairs in the courthouse, the jurors were taking a hard look at the forensics in the case. Remember, the prosecution had argued the struggle in the Mitsubishi could not have happened the way Carlos said it did. They'd shown jurors a video demonstration to show how difficult it would have been for Carlos to end up in the back seat.
Well, his knee is in my side.
Right.
He'd have had to go through the narrow opening of the SUV's console, end up in the back with the gunman, and all the while not wake up his sleeping wife.
What are his feet doing right now? He's trying.
Right now, he's kneeling on the seat. And
then the prosecution argued there was the angle of the bullets. Peggy shot level in the head. Another gunshot fired at a 90-degree angle through the back window. All of this during a wild struggle. Was it possible? Some jurors thought yes.
They alluded to the fact that he's too tall, too big of a guy to be able to fit through such a small area between the driver's seat and the passenger seat.
What'd you think? Could it be done?
Yes, I think it could be done based on the circumstances. Could have happened, absolutely.
But some of the jurors weren't so sure.
You know, it was a narrow car. It was a very strenuous, tough job to get into that back seat. And then... what was left in the back seat seemed to be in a very orderly shape.
For me, I found that most damaging. I mean, the fact that his wife never woke up, car traveling at 45 miles an hour, comes to a stop, she does not wake up, someone forces you off the road in a dark road, and not once did he wake his wife up to say, we might be in trouble.
But remember, Carlos had also taken a shot to the stomach.
When I first heard about the case, I said, are they kidding? Who's going to shoot himself in the stomach, you know?
Somebody had to shoot him.
It is strange. She's dead. He's wounded. That's a long way to go.
Absolutely.
To throw the police off your case, huh?
Right.
And there was the prosecutor's star witness. Mark Gazzola had testified that he saw the vintage Walther PPK in Carlos's house just 5 months before the shooting.
He really identified the gun very clearly.
How believable a witness was he to y'all?
Very
believable. Yeah.
Finally, after a day and a half of deliberations, they had reached a decision. Their verdict? Carlos Perez Olivo, guilty of murdering his wife, Peggy.
Guilty. Yeah. To me, it was a shock. I believe to the attorneys it was a shock. To my family, it was a shock.
His son, Merced, was away from the courthouse when the verdict was read. He ran back to get the news.
I didn't even know how to react. It just felt like the sickest joke of my life had been played on me. You know, just it didn't compute. It didn't make sense. I didn't understand how he could be guilty. The trial had gone so well. From that, it was just like a fuse going off, and I remember just seeing, like, blacking out almost, like, not being able to see, just going red.
He was so angry, he put his fist right through the plaster of the courthouse wall.
I broke the wall, you know, I went ballistic, and I just the rage, it was uncontrollable, but it caught me so off guard, because I was so sure they were going to find him innocent.
Alicia learned of the guilty verdict by phone. She headed to a park.
I was just in shock. It was just like, it was just take a deep breath and time to, you know, keep going. Because obviously there's nothing I can do about it. I have to deal with this now.
But the jurors, those with the beliefs that mattered, were convinced that Carlos Perez Olivo had indeed murdered his wife of 3 decades.
And it was like a puzzle. It was like all the pieces fit in. You know, it was the money, the fact that he did have this other love interest, and then the fact that he was a criminal attorney. He elevated himself in his own mind that, you know, he can outfox all these policemen. And the fact that he shot himself, I think he thought that would be the coup de grace, that nobody would ever figure that he would shoot himself.
District Attorney DeFiore had no doubt that Carlos Perez Olivo did indeed kill his wife in cold blood.
I believe that there are people who are willing to put their own selfish, self-focused needs above all those around them, including the people that they are supposed to love and protect and care for.
Justice served.
I think that justice has most definitely been served.
And the judge apparently agreed.
The defendant is a master of deceit who contrived a diabolical plan to murder his wife for his own financial gain.
She sentenced Carlos to the maximum, 25 years to life.
I'll die in jail. I do believe that we all have a destiny, and there's nothing you can do to change it. I can put up with anything. I can put up with the humiliations, people asking me questions if I killed my wife or not. I can put up with being in jail for the rest of my life. Maybe in part it's easier because I'm kind of half empty after she died.
You didn't shoot her?
No. No.
But that's not what the jury thought happened on that November night. So the one-time criminal defense lawyer who used his skills to keep clients out of prison is now himself an inmate with a number and a jumpsuit.